We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight we are looking at the second episode of the Omega Factor Visitations. In a dark, spooky old house, two men are testing recording equipment, but things aren't going well. The recordings are all contaminated by strange sounds, like voices laughing and screaming. One of the men is attacked by something unseen. He appears to be possessed and kills his co-worker. Back in London, Tom Crane confronts his brother. His brother has been secretly involved with Department 7 and testing Tom's psychic abilities without his knowledge. The brother appears supremely uninformed about what he was doing and was unaware that Tom's wife's death wasn't an accident. The brother offers to loan Tom his flat in Edinburgh so that he can move there. The brother has conveniently received a grant to leave the country and will obviously have no further part in the series, I'm sure. Now, in Edinburgh, Tom begins work with Department 7 by testing his abilities. His ability to discern Zener cards is amazing. Still more inaccurate than accurate, but almost double the success rate of random chance. In a later experiment, Tom is shown pictures on a wall, and, without realizing it, he also sees a vision of the man who was possessed earlier in the episode. Tom has strong reservations about Dr. Martindale, the functional head of Department 7. He doesn't trust him, and the only reason he's working with him is to find Drexler, the man who murdered his wife. Special Branch calls in Department 7 concerning the events at the house. Tom and Anne are assigned to investigate, as are two other scientists who are not told about the potential danger of the situation. This doesn't improve Tom's opinion of Dr. Martindale. Tom is depressed about his wife's death and visits a medium to try to contact her. It's too soon after her death, the medium says, but she's there, and she'll make contact when the time is right. The medium also detects Tom's latent, undeveloped powers, and also that there's grave menace and danger approaching him. Unbeknownst to Tom, as he walks home, Morag, the ghostly assistant from Drexler's shop and the spectral figure that appeared on the road causing the crash that killed his wife, is following him down the road. The next morning, they visit the hospital where the possessed man has been catatonic since the event. Tom recognizes him as the man he saw during the experiment. The man has recently come out of his coma, and at first is just confused and cannot remember. But when Martindale enters the room, he recognizes him. His voice changes, and he tries to kill him. They get Martindale out, but soon thereafter the man dies, apparently of natural causes. The investigation moves to the house, where they set up all manner of ghostbustery equipment, like thermometers and infrared cameras. Spooky things begin to happen. Tom is attacked, and it appears is being possessed. He calls on his dead wife, Julia, to help. Suddenly, he has fought off the possession attempt. Later, Tom explains that he called for his wife, but it was too soon for her to help. Instead, Morag appeared. What does it mean? Okay, well, episode two. Now we're getting into the meat of the show. What did you think?
Well, I mean, it's the meat of the show, but actually, I rather enjoyed the setup. What I'm liking about this is just atmosphere, because it didn't, I mean, on reflection, that was a fairly lengthy synopsis. And
for sure, so, not much happened in.
Well, yeah. I got to the end of it and I felt not much had happened. I'd enjoyed watching it because the spookiness is good and the atmosphere is good. And it's interesting seeing how these characters develop. But the thing that I really liked from the setup episode was this whole kind of paranoia thing. Not quite knowing what everyone's agenda is, not quite knowing whether people are who they say they are and whose side they're on. And in this one, a little bit that settles down. We know who Martindale is and what his role is, even if his agenda is a bit suspect. You know, we know Anne is someone that we can trust.
I'll agree with that. I'll agree with that. There is really, even though Martindale is... Tom doesn't trust him, as a member of the audience, I kind of do already. I mean, yeah. I know he's one of the good guys. He may be, I wouldn't say unpleasant, that's not quite what I mean, but he may not be conventionally a nice guy, but he's on the side of the angels.
Well, he's on the side of he's on the side of doing his job, and his job is working for the government, and so he's not a criminal, if you like, in that sense.
Yeah, I don't, again, we talked about that last time. They have that sort of presentation that, hey, the government's good, that we're doing this for the good of the people, and so I'm carrying that forward here. He's not working for some shadowy conspiracy government organization that's trying to take over the government or suppress your civil liberties or anything like that. It's a
he's working within the law, and the law, if it needs to accommodate him, it will. But that's still not the same as necessarily saying he's sympathetic to Crane, or that he's a compassionate man, or that he's,
I think,
as you say, not necessarily a nice,
scientific
person.
Attachment, kind of.
But I like Carlyle's performance in this, because he does, although he's not necessarily a sympathetic character, he does, and it's also the way he's written. He handles Crane and he handles Anne very well.
Mm-hmm.
So you can kind of understand why they work for him, even though they might not feel like they particularly like him or regard him as a friend. So all of that interplay I'm enjoying, I think.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, and I'm watching this episode, and I'm three quarters of the way into it, and I'm like, this is amazing. Three quarters of the way into the episode, and we haven't gotten to the haunted house that we know that this program is inevitably leading us to. And yet, it's creepy all along the way.
Yeah.
And I can't exactly explain why. It's not necessarily creepy when he's in the lab, but you know, when he visits the medium, there's this sort of air of, that it's very well done. And they've, of course,
it's
established
all performances,
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've got that in my notes. It's like, I am, you know, vastly impressed and deeply saddened at the same time at how well they convey creepy, spooky, ghostly, without any special effects to speak of whatsoever. We never see the thing. You know, whatever terrified the heck of the guy at the beginning, or Tom, or anything, we don't see it. They don't have to spend their fortune.
Well,
they have achieved.
We have his red glowing eyes.
We did that, but I mean, they achieved.
We'd have been better without.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. Very, very sparingly used, but you know, we would never allow the creature to go unseen in a modern show, even if it's just a brief flash. They just couldn't do it. They couldn't allow you to have your own imagination, and you know,
I remember thinking that about in particular in kind of recent Doctor Who, the episode Cold War, mm-hmm. where they did actually keep the monster back for a little while, and it worked so much better. And before you actually saw, you know, what the Ice Warrior looked like.
And it wasn't that the Ice Warrior was badly done, because it wasn't.
No.
It's just that they are able to create suspense and tension that way that showing it does not achieve. So, you know, I didn't show this to my kids, but it was purely an accident that they weren't there when I was watching it. And while I was watching it, I'm like, I'm not going to either. Because if it gives me a little bit of the creep sitting there by myself in a dark house watching it, I don't want to be up at 2 in the morning with a screaming kid. So
yeah.
I kind of put that on as like, you know, it's not that I would censor the material from them, but I would not subject them to that exactly. Maybe the older one, but kind of hard to say. Definitely not the younger one, and it's not that there's anything in it that's horrific or that they wouldn't understand. It's just that they have built it up so well that it's creepy enough that I suspect it induced a little bit of anxiousness. That's not the word I'm looking for, but it'll have to do. Anyway, I liked it.
Terror, maybe.
Yeah, well, apprehension.
I mean, there's something very unsettling about it.
Yeah, and I think it's more so than the previous episode. I mean, in the previous episode, we are presented with the fact that these powers are lethal. So it's not just a game where things are flying around the room or people are reading cards. There is real peril at hand But in this one, I think it steps it up a notch. This is a genuine scary haunted house.
Yeah.
Kind of a ring.
Yeah, because the power is beyond all of them. They can't, it becomes quickly clear that there's nothing they can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And obviously Tom, even though, quote unquote, his powers are phenomenal, he's out of his depth as well. So
yeah, because he's a sensitive. He's not, you know, I was kind of sitting there thinking, like, in Harry Potter, he'd have had 3 or 4 years of Defense Against the Dark Arts classes before he got into this situation. But he has no idea how to use what he can do. All he's apparently done so far is sit in chairs and stare at screens and look at cards.
Yeah. Where do you learn that? I mean, even the medium kind of makes a comment to it's undeveloped, but how does he develop it? I mean, it isn't like Harry Potter where we have Hogwarts to send him to, or is it? Maybe there is a Hogwarts out there for people like him and that we don't know about it yet, but there's
it depends what their level of knowledge and understanding is about this stuff. Maybe there is. I mean, we get the sense that Drexel has in some way developed his skills. I mean, that, I guess, is largely self-taught.
Yeah, see, I mean, sometimes
But Crane has had no time where he's actually had awareness of his skills. So he hasn't even been able to experiment for himself. You know, how can I shut it? Can I shut things out? Can I control things? You know, to what extent? He's essentially just a victim of the experiences that his sensitivity gives him.
Sensory overload kind of thing.
Hmm. And you know, that's very much what appears to be going on. And so he's gone from being
overload.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But he's gone from being quite a sort of resourceful and, you know, fairly I suppose self-guided kind of heroic investigative journalist type, mm-hmm. to being someone who really is, I mean, as you say, he's out of his depth. He doesn't know a great deal about what's going on. He doesn't know a great deal about how to control the skills he has. The skills he had as a journalist, he knew how to use in order to pursue a story, and he was good at that. But that's useless in this situation.
I guess to some degree. I mean, as an investigator working with Department 7, it should still come in good stead. One of the things I like is the fact that when he meets... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, there's no one for him to interview. There's no one for him to threaten, to get the story from. He doesn't have to think about how to spin it, to publish it to an audience or whatever. All of his investigative skills are the wrong skills.
I suppose. I was going to say, one of the things I like is the fact that when he goes to the medium and she says, you know, I think, you know, you could help yourself. And he doesn't deny it. He doesn't pull the, well, I'm still kind of, I don't know if I believe this stuff. No, he believes it. He's bought in. It's like, yep, I do apparently have some talent in that way. He doesn't overplay it or he doesn't underplay it. He just acknowledges the fact that, yep, there is something going on there. And I like that. You know, we just got it out of the way. It's been demonstrated to him clearly that it does exist, and he accepts it and goes on. And so that, you know, it's a good groundwork for him to develop it. You know, there's different models in fiction, because this is just fiction, on how people take these skills and become adept at them. Obviously, at one end, you have Harry Potter, where you've got them, but you have to go to school and learn. And I think at the opposite end, it's one of those things where you just sort of break out at a certain age and your powers become more powerful and refined just as you go through time. And I'm wondering where he falls on that spectrum. You know, does he have to practice it to get better at it? Or is it something that he'll just get better at with time? Will he discover new powers? And at the moment, he just seems to be able to draw up visions. I think that's all we've seen from him. Drexler obviously has the ability to project things. So do they have different skill sets? Or, you know, is there different groups of psychic people that have different town. Maybe there's somebody who has telekinesis and somebody who's a telepath will never get telekinesis, or perhaps it's all the same power base and they can all develop all the same skills. I don't know. I mean, we're not getting that picture yet.
No, I mean, it could be that they have completely different abilities, but I think to some degree it has to be the case that without ever having experienced them before, he can do it's purely a reflex, if you like. There's no sense in which you control. It's kind of like having to learn to walk again or something. You have to learn, you know, when your neurons fire, which muscles react and which limbs that drives, kind of thing, if that makes sense. And so it might be with this, you know, if you do have the ability to move objects with your mind, well, then you have to work out what it is you do in your mind in order to make a particular object move and, you know, move the table lamp and not the telly, that kind of.
Right.
But this thing that I suppose I disliked a little bit about this episode is the way in which all of these things do seem to have been lumped in together to some degree, because you can have telepathy and telekinesis, and to some extent that is postulating something beyond the known physical realm, if you like. But this leaps straight into the... I mean, this is Ghosts episode 2. I don't know whether this is going to come back.
You're right. This is Ghosts.
But it's the spiritual. It's separating the spirit from the body. The idea that his wife will still, you know, you could have a completely, if you approach this, and I suppose it's the kind of mindset I tend to come from a completely materialist, reductionist viewpoint, but to say there are physical properties that we don't yet understand, ways in which we, you know, our minds are, our brains, in effect, can actually interact with the physical world around us.
In other words, that, telekinesis might be real, but ghosts, yeah, no.
That could be the story here. Or you could take the alternative approach, the kind of dualistic viewpoint, that the fact that telepathy is possible and that people can have telekinetic powers means that there must be something above and beyond the purely physical. The mind isn't just the brain itself, and that there must be something, therefore, that could, in theory at least, exist even when the body dies, a spirit or a soul or consciousness, however you want to describe it, could then, you know, go on to another place and be contacted, yada, yada. So there are these two alternative viewpoints that I think... can't be assumed, but they're jumping straight into it without exploring the possibility, and to me that seems like a bit of a missed opportunity to kind of they could have explored a little bit more about what agents like Drexel could do using their telekinetic and telepathic powers, and saved up this whole exploration of the spirits and the spiritual for perhaps a subsequent episode.
Yeah, I was going to say, so in the last episode, we obviously, anything that he saw could have simply been a vision, a projected mind image that was placed on him, as opposed to an actual thing following him down the streets and causing the lights to go out. It could just be fear placed in the mind. So in this episode, I think we've firmly established that this is a universe that ghosts exist.
But it's not just that we've established that, it's that Crane just seems to have jumped straight to it, which...
Doesn't that seem like a sort of 1970s attitude, though? Wasn't that really sort of the... whether or not it was scientifically based, but I mean, wasn't that really sort of the popular conception of these psychic powers, was that it was also spiritualism?
Very probably, yeah. I mean, like I say, I come at it with an attitude that is, you know, very much I mean, I don't know. Partly that, but also, I guess different people will come at it with different viewpoints.
Hmm. We do know that in the last episode, Drexler seemed to imply that there was something to the Satan myth, because they're using the pentagrams, which is usually associated with cults of devil worship and whatnot. So I guess we could have extrapolated last time that they were hinting at something beyond the supernatural as opposed to supernormal capabilities.
Yes.
Of people. Well, let's take a look at the various little, because this is really sort of almost a series of little acts in a play. It's not like a three act play or a four act play. They're almost vignettes. So we have our scene with Tom and his brother at the beginning. What did you make of that?
I was actually quite worried about it, because it seemed to me that the whole thing had, in the first episode, had kind of trotted along at a good pace. We'd kind of established relationships and carried things forward and carried the story forward through these scenes, which were primarily these kind of duologues with just the two characters. Mm. And, you know, where there'd been the opportunity to kind of overplay things or dwell on things, so, like the example you gave where Crane was talking to the medium and he just accepted that, you know, he had these powers. It didn't have to become a big deal, and we didn't have to delve into how he was feeling about that and all the kinds of things that would happen now. And yet there was something a bit sort of gratuitous, if you like, about all the kind of recriminations between the brothers at the beginning that felt a bit more like a soap opera melodrama than the style that had been established.
I could not figure out watching that scene. So last time, you know, he conveniently had a brother that was in Edinburgh where mm-hmm. he was going. Okay, fine. And his brother's not going to be there. And then we see that the brother has been working with Martindale, or that Martindale knows him, even though at that point we don't know who Martindale is. And then the brother's out of the way while he's there. Well, I suppose you could assume that that's because they don't want to taint the experiment by getting them too close to one another. So they're keeping them apart. I kind of figured the brother would be playing a bigger part in this story this time, because now there's no need to keep them apart. He lives in Edinburgh. He's moving to Edinburgh.
A lesser part in the story, because his role is done.
That's right. And so they bring him back to kick him back out of the story. And they go to great lengths to basically say, I didn't even know what I was doing. I don't know who this Erskine guy is. I barely ever met Martindale. They were going to tell you. So I just, you know, did this experiment. And it doesn't, not only does it kind of come off as dismissive of the brother, and then conveniently I got a grant to go to another country and I'll be gone so you can have my apartment. I genuinely wonder if I joked about it in the recap that, you know, we're not going to see him again. I don't know that that's true.
No, it felt to me like the scene was on. It was setting something up in their relationship.
Yeah.
And that was when I was watching the scene, I was thinking, well, God, are we going to have this whole episode about brothers falling out and all this kind of tedious stuff. But whatever it was setting up is clearly something that is going to take longer to resolve.
Yeah. So I'm not sure.
And hopefully be more interesting than I feared.
The brother's acting was appalling.
Well, it didn't help.
I was watching, I thought, wow, this guy is really either not good, or just the director has not given him the right direction, because it just really comes off badly. So another thing that's kind of interesting is I like the fact that they managed to take relatively meaningless trips to Edinburgh tourist attractions, so that we can get a shot of how lovely Edinburgh is. Come here, tourism dollars. Come on, folks. so far, I'm recognizing.
Well, it's a cheap set.
Yes.
And, it's more of the duo. I mean, we obviously do have the scene, the haunted house scenes, where there are four of them together, but there's more of the kind of duologues as he goes on these walks with Anne.
That's true.
So you might as well have some good scenery while you're doing it.
And I think they are setting her up to fall for him very quickly. I mean, very quickly. Perhaps so quickly it's not even appropriate. Because his wife's only been dead 2 weeks.
Well, I'm not certain that she wasn't interested before she died.
fair enough. I think it did seem a little overly familiar for someone who is a friend of the wife, not a friend of Tom.
Well, the thing that puzzled me was that there was less concern on her part or grief or just talking about the wife from her. You know, it's clear how much he is thinking about her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, although she would have been less close, obviously, they were friends. But I don't know. To me, that just seemed a little bit surprising. But, yeah, clearly Anne is interested, I think.
Do you think she's had a thing with Martindale? Was she underplaying that I've been to the theater with him a few times? I don't know
what's going on there.
Because then there's a triangle.
I'm not sensing any. She was obviously quite keen to kind of downplay it when the possibility of going to the flicks with Crane.
Wait a minute. Who was the guy who was trying to marry her in the last episode? Was that Martindale?
No, that was some other guy.
That was some other guy who is gone. Come to think of it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, she's obviously beating them off from her door, and understandably so.
Yeah, all right. So far, based on the cast we've seen so far, absolutely. Absolutely. let's see, what else did we have in this episode that was... we have the scene with the medium. Obviously, Tom's upset. He's gone. He sought out a medium. How does he know a medium? That's the other thing. There's another thing about this show. Clearly, there are a bunch of people who have this gift or something. Because Anne and Martindale are talking about, is it Marion?
Yeah.
Who is obviously knows a bunch of this stuff and is apparently in some way sensitive, but she's out of the country or out of town or somewhere. And so there is just this, there's almost like this cast of characters that's sprouting out that seem to be known, and at the same time, I don't know, like, so Tom goes to the medium. Is this a medium that Anne and Martindale already know about? Or is this, like, yet another person in the side?
I don't think they know about her, because they don't, when Crane tells Anne, at least Anne doesn't, he tells her, he doesn't say, I've been to see, and then name her. He says, I've been to see a medium. So it's not like he's expecting it to be someone that she's familiar with.
Otherwise,
why not say who?
When Anne says, what did he say? It could just be that Anne knows there's at least one guy medium in town, too. You know, that could be indicative that we're supposed to get that, yeah, you know, there's a dime a dozen in Edinburgh. And maybe they are.
Well, yeah. I quite like that about, you know, you mentioned Marion and what they're doing is they're creating in it because it's still essentially such a small cast show. They're creating this whole world around it. There's this team in Department 7, which they're creating without having to hire anyone to play Marion.
Mm-hmm.
And they're creating the sense that there are these networks out there, you know, within Edinburgh and within this kind of world of extrasensory whatnot. And I quite like that. I mean, it's not just the efficiency of it, you know, the fact that they don't have to do all the establishing stuff and tediously show Crane going around asking or looking up adverts mm-hmm. for mediums or whatever. It's not just that. It's actually that it does make the world bigger, and I like that.
Yeah, I really have very few complaints about the show. I'm enjoying it immensely so far. Let's see. Obviously, we talked a little bit about Tom and Martindale's. Tom sort of, is distrust the right word? Does he He kind of throws out there, what was Anne doing with you? Is he harboring the notion that there might have been an affair going on? Or did Martindale satisfy his concern?
I'm not sure that's his. I'm not sure that's his worry, but
you know,
He clearly doesn't trust him. Again, you know, that scene was one that I kind of felt, oh God, you know, more recriminations, because it didn't quite feel like the way Crane would play it necessarily, because he just comes sort of straight out and confronts him with the questions, whereas you think he would be a little bit more circumspect, particularly as a journalist, you know, not expecting to get answers in that way. But the answers he does get obviously don't satisfy him, and he still doesn't trust Martindale.
So here's one his reporter skills could do. He could dig up information on Martindale.
Yeah, and that's what I would expect him to do.
To see what we can find about the guy. He also has I think it comes up more than once in the episode, but I think it comes up before it's even meaningful in the episode, that he seems to have an opinion that Martindale would put people in danger.
Yeah.
Towards the end, it makes sense, because he's going to send the team into the haunted house. He's not going to tell them that somebody was murdered there by a ghost.
But that's connected with his wife as well, isn't it?
I guess maybe. Is he?
Because could Martindale have prevented his wife's death? Could he have known what Drexel could or would do? What did Martindale warn his wife? You know, because she was working for him, so she was likely to put herself in danger. But did she know how much danger, etc., etc.? So I think those are all part of the reasons why he doesn't trust him.
Because I think Tom gets the feeling that he was the intended victim in the accident. Well, he basically says as much at one point.
I wasn't sure whether he said that he thought he was the intended victim, or he just had survivor's guilt. I wish I'd been the one who died, because I'm not sure.
No, I thought he did.
He
say
was
at one
the
point.
Intended victim.
I thought he did say that in this episode at one point, where he said, "I'm not sure." He got the right target or something. I forgot what the exact words were, but it implied that I was supposed to die in the car accident, not her.
I inferred was he was saying, "I wish I had died, not her,"
because I think that Drexler's threat was pretty clear. You're going to
regret
it.
But it wasn't a threat against his life.
No, it was a threat. You're going to regret it. You can't regret it if you're dead. Of course, in a ghost world, I guess you can. But that throws a certain logic out the window. But yes, I mean, I thought that Drexler was threatening to make his life miserable, and killing his wife fits that pattern quite nicely. Unless, all right, we'll skip ahead. What the heck is Morag doing? And yes, I did look it up to figure out that was Morag, because they keep showing her name in the credits, and I don't think they've ever called her. That's the girl that was the receptionist at the bookstore in the first episode, and who showed up by the graveside at the end of the first episode and was walking down the street this time, and also showed up in the haunted house at the end. And obviously Tom is saying she's the one that staved off the possession. What's up with that? Is she a ghost? Was she a ghost when she was in Drexler's bookshop? Is she helping Tom? Is she helping Drexler somehow? Is Drexler still playing a game?
I think the obvious inference is that she's either working for Drexler, or she is a spectre projected by him or controlled by him in some way. But I mean, I think they're good questions. You do start to question it. Well, you know, where do her loyalties lie? What is she doing here? Can you assume that the fact that she's there means, you know, Drexel is somewhere in the wings pulling the strings? Or is she actually there of her own volition for some reason?
Tom could have
because she knows something.
I was going to say, Tom could have driven off the road because of the visions that were splattering all over his field of vision. I mean, the girl was just the icing on the cake at the end.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that she might have been there to help him, for all we know. Like, and didn't succeed.
Well, no.
Alternatively, you know, maybe Drexler has plans for Tom. If Tom is so strong, maybe, I don't know, maybe he's trying to harvest something from him, maybe himself as all, and then the girl is, well, we can't let him die too soon because we need him for something. Like he's going to be a sacrifice at the end of the series or something that they need Tom for, and so she's acting as a watchdog. Because I thought it was very odd when Tom was saying he called out to Julia, but his wife, but it was too soon. So he'd taken on board what the medium said, and I'm taking from that he confirmed that in his own way from what was happening, and then the girl showed up, and at first I think I forgot what Anne said, but it was something like was she helping Julia? That was it. So he said, I tried to call Julia, but she couldn't do it. And then this other one showed up, and Anne says, was she helping her? And then Tom says, well, I told you about the girl at the road, right? And then caused me to drive off the thing. And then Anne's response is, retribution? Retribution for what? I didn't even understand that question. It's like, why would you come up with that? I don't get it. And I feel like I missed something in the process, but because it didn't seem like she was affecting
retribution. Do you think Anne knows something and is holding out, or what do you think's going on
did
there?
Did a girl die in the house? Wasn't that it? There was a girl died. That's the yes. one that died that Drexler got hounded for. Maybe
you think that could be Morag?
Yeah, maybe.
But why would if she is a ghost? Why would she have been in the bookshop? I mean.
I don't know.
If Drexel's her killer, why would she want to have anything to do with him?
Do we know that Drexler even knew she was there? Did he ever talk to her? That would be weird if she was a ghost that he didn't see.
Wouldn't it?
And I'm going to have to go back and watch that again. I don't know. It's a good mystery there. If it had been the ghost of the girl that was killed in the house, then the phrase retribution might make sense, that she's fighting against whatever evil in the house killed her.
Yeah, and so maybe that's what Anne thinks.
And she doesn't have the information to do that, to come to that conclusion, unless she knows more than she's telling. Dun, dun, dun. I think we've discovered something about Anne. And he calls her on that at one point, too, doesn't he? When she's recounting the story of the house. She goes a long way into that story before she gets to
mention Drexler. Yeah.
And
he says, you held that back.
You held that back. And I didn't feel that she did. I mean, she was telling the story in a chronological order, and that's kind of the punchline. I probably would have held it back if I was explaining it to somebody. I don't think I would have started off and go, yeah, this was Drexler's house, and it's got a heck of a... I wouldn't do that. I probably, if only...
Well, it depends if you're telling the story for effect or if you're conveying information. Because if you want someone to pay attention, you might say, I'm telling you this because it's Drexel's house and here are the details, rather than building it up to a punchline for the pure drama for the theatre of it.
But she wasn't telling it in a theatrical way, and so she was telling it...
No, but she obviously.
So it seems...
I thought she quite. She was looking for the reaction. She was quite pleased that there were that it had an effect on him.
Interesting. A couple of observations. Let's see with the haunted house at the end. The investigation. So we have the old tropes: the digital thermometer. We've got the infrared camera that's triggered to go off. Not sure what triggered the camera to go off, but something is triggering. I don't think they explained what caused that. Was it trip wires or infrared beams or what? But the cameras were going off, flashing pictures. We never even see them. Thank you, special effects department. Didn't even need to do that.
I say the special effects department when they played the slow down tapes, it sounded almost exactly like the Vogons in the original Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
The part that I thought was funny was, and maybe it's because I listen to podcasts at double speed all the time, but the sounds of the laughing and the screaming in the background of that sounded perfectly ordinary laughing and screaming and people talking to me. And then they slow it down.
People are laughing and screaming in the podcasts you listen to.
Yeah. Well, yeah, yes, possibly. Depends on whether we're reviewing something that people didn't like. But you know what I mean. They didn't sound that – they weren't unintelligible to me. I'm listening to it. And it's like, okay, that's people screaming, laughing, talking, and okay. Then they slow it down, and it's like, dun, dun, dun. The people in the room are like, oh, my gosh, that's voices. Like, yeah.
But you can hear the words, isn't that – I mean –
I guess I couldn't hear – I couldn't make couple words here and there. It sounded mostly French.
I have to say I couldn't have transcribed it myself, but I could make out that there were words.
Yeah,
and that seemed to me
– I thought I could make out there were words to begin with. I just didn't know what – you know, they were Pig Latin or something that I didn't get. But it was clearly people speaking, and slowed down, it's clearly people speaking. Slowly. Anyway, I there was a little I thought they were trying to build. I also love the fact that you have a tape that you play and then you stop it and they go, and now listen to it slowed down, and you start the same tape in the same position and suddenly it's now the other segment. And I know that could be where they stopped it and he managed to stop it exactly on that spot, but I don't buy that. That's
because the original tape is reel to reel, so they've recorded it onto a compact cassette at normal speed, and then they've recorded it onto the same compact cassette at slow speed.
And he
knows you've got 10 seconds of the one, and then stops it.
Uh-huh.
10 seconds
uh-huh.
in.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Or it wasn't really playing on that tape recorder; it was being fed in later on, and they just didn't.
Yeah.
It anyway.
That's what I would have done if I'd been Martindale. I'd have known exactly at what point to click it off.
Got the counter marks down.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, God, I remember. Oh, yeah, tape. Dear. How did we cope?
In the house, of course, Tom makes a comment about Martindale sending in the other two people without giving them warning about the danger. And guess what? Tom only warns one of them that there might be danger.
Yeah, true.
And he doesn't warn the other one, and apparently they don't have any protocol about don't investigate strange, mysterious sounds in a haunted house by yourself in the dark. That seems like rule number one.
Or don't go and get a sandwich by yourself.
Yes.
Because he wasn't actually investigating, was he?
Well, I suppose he was.
Yes.
He could have been breaking protocol. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have definitely gone back to the people in the room and say, hey, guys, there's something happening here. I would not go up those stairs. Even if I didn't know there'd been a murder recently in the house, if I was investigating a phenomenon like that, I would absolutely want witnesses.
Yeah.
And backup. So I thought that was particularly – I was just screaming at the TV. Do not go on your – why did the food go bad? What was that? I mean, apart from a visual clue that something's happening.
I don't know, because I still don't really know what happened.
Right. Who did he encounter up top? Was it Morag?
Ultimately. Well, I don't know. Because at the beginning of the episode, we have the, what is it? But whatever it is, we have its point of view.
Mm-hmm.
That's the shot we get at the beginning of the episode. So, I mean, I know we've commented on the fact that we never see it, but... It's not only that, we still don't really know what it is. If it was sapphire and steel, the food would go bad because time was breaking through.
Right. This show does remind me of quite a bit of sapphire and steel.
Yeah, I can see.
Mostly from the production design, but yeah.
Yeah. But also the sensibility and the way of using, I suppose, the kind of asset... I was going to say the assets that they had, but actually it's not that, is it? It's the style. It's what we talked about before. It's the fact that it's a kind of television that in the last 20 years has just vanished, but there's no reason why you couldn't make it now. It's just the people, the fools, they wouldn't watch it.
I'm beginning to come to the opinion that actually that may be true. that people wouldn't watch it, even if it was the best thing ever. I'm beginning to think that might be true, that there are modes of storytelling that you just can't engage people in. Anyway.
But you could once.
Yes, you could once.
It's just, its expectations have changed.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, the guy goes off, he's investigating, something scares him, he bounces down the stairs, he's hurt, they take him into the room. Tom decides, well, I guess it's time for me to go out there and do some investigating, and everyone else stays behind, kind of, okay, there you go. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
The way Anne's like, well, there you go, Tom, good luck. How about I'll go with you, or like, here, take the camera, or...
Yeah, I'll come and transcribe, or, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have been volunteering in that situation.
I agree, but I wouldn't be working in that bureau.
I'll just stay here and look after the equipment.
Yeah, which is the other thing. The guy with the headphones on is they have been locked in a room by a ghost. And there's a guy in the other room screaming and being attacked, and he's just sitting there looking at the tape recorder with his headphone on. They're not even trying to get out of the room. They're not trying to do anything. They are completely letting Tom suffer this on his own. And I'm wondering if that's intentional.
Well, except Anne tries to break the glass with a microphone.
Right. When Anne sees that his face has gone not red weird, but weird, and she tries to... Okay, all right, same thing. She smashes it with a microphone. It does not break, right? And... then the next time we see her, she's on the floor, and the guy with the headphones is actually tending to the little wound on her knuckle.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has bothered to go out and try to help Tom. They're still just sitting in that room, and, you know, Tom walks in the door, and...
We don't know when the door got unlocked.
No, but I'm still thinking you might be... You might be trying to help her break the window. You might be trying to help get out of the room, but he's not. And they're tending to a wound that is basically nothing. And they got the other guy who's obviously much more hurt. They're not paying any attention to him. And Tom comes in and they're all like, ooh, I'm a little scared here. Yeah, shouldn't we get this guy to the hospital? Oh, okay, everything's fine. I thought that was very weird. I don't know if they were going for the idea that they were experimenting on Tom. They were intentionally being detached from him and not helping because he's the subject.
Mm.
Obviously, I think if we run with that, when Anne tried to break the window, I think that was personal concern for Tom overriding her job.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't let this go on. He's got a problem for real. And then tried to do something, but
insufficient data. We can't call it based on what we've seen so far. We need to know more about these people and how they behave.
But these things did not in any way detract from the story, and it wasn't until I thought about it. Well, maybe a little bit. I thought of it as sort of odd way of doing things, but it's not until I really think about it that I realize this could be a setup for something further down the road. And I do truly appreciate that, because there's nothing I hate worse than when they telegraph that they're setting something up for down the road in a show, because then that's like, oh yeah, we're being all story arc-y, and that was going to come back for you later. I dislike that, but I love when you can see something four or five episodes down the road and suddenly a thing that may have just slightly felt out of place earlier clicks in. So I'm hoping, I don't know if that's true at this stage, because neither you nor I have watched this show through. I'm hoping that's the way it works out, and I'll be very impressed if it does. They did have that sequence where the guy in the hospital bed was struggling, and there was the very bad video effect aura around him that only Tom could see. But I mean, I think that's just in keeping with, let's try this. A thing possesses the guy. The guy is taken to the hospital. When he gets to the hospital, he's clearly still got the thing in him. I think that's what that's conveying, right? And he wrote the stuff on the paper that sounds like he was getting out. Now the guy dies, What happened to the aura? Did it go back to the house? And is that what was attacking Tom, or was it a different thing?
Well, since I'm not really sure what the aura was, I don't know. I mean, because there's the possibility that there's more than one malevolent entity in the house.
Mm-hmm. No, there's obviously lots of voices, so...
Or it could be the same. And there was the suggestion that the chap died because he was, you know, struggling with being possessed.
Mm-hmm.
So that having it, being ejected from him might not have been the, whatever it is, spirit entity's choice. But then if it is ejected and yet can survive, does that leave it hanging around the hospital? Is that haunted now? Or would it have been able to make its way back? I mean, we just don't know.
All right. Well, when we come back for the next episode of The Omega Factor, it will be the one, number three, which name I don't know off the top of my head. But Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's been a pleasure as always. And I think the next one might be called Night Games.
That does sound right. And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fusionpatrol. Our Twitter username is @fusionpatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/fusionpatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.